The previous program, we just heard a encore broadcast of the last 2 hours of the People's Poor People's Campaign national call for moral revival. And that was heard, brought to you by the fine folks of Pacifica Radio, which that is sponsored by the listening audience of Pacifica, and specifically WBAI listeners as well. And the reason why I'm bringing all of this up is because, just as a quick reminder, we couldn't do the things that we have done if it wasn't for the listeners like yourselves continuing to support this institution since 1960. So, real quick, show your support to this radio station by calling 212-209-2950 or go to give to WBAI.org online. That's 212-209-2950 or go to give to WBAI.org online. All right, it is now 1 minute past 5 p.m. Stay tuned for Deadline NYC with Tom Robbins here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned.
Here's some advice for your friend. Don't press your luck. Lay off of me. Don't print that story.
What's that supposed to be? An order?
Listen to me! Print that story, you're a dead man!
It's not just me anymore. You'd have to stop every newspaper in the country now, and you're not big enough for that job. People like you have tried it before, with bullets, prison, censorship. But as long as even one newspaper will print the truth, you're finished.
That noise, what's that racket?
That's the press, baby. The press. And there's nothing you can do about it. Nothing.
It's a city full of fun. I say, welcome to New York, brother. It's a city full of fun. Yeah. They got plenty of rats and roaches, enough welfare for everyone.
A whole lot of police cars. Leon Thomas there on vocals, Johnny Hodges, alto sax, welcoming us to New York, or at least the New York of 1970. And before that, the unmistakable voice of Humphrey Bogart playing the tough guy newspaper editor in the 1952 film classic Deadline USA, telling the racketeer there's no way, baby, to stop a free press. My name's Tom Robbins. I've taken that great movie title for the name of this show, which I call Deadline NYC. Back in 2006, I wrote a story for the Village Voice about an attorney named Walter Mack, who was our guest this evening. The title of the story was The Man Who Wanted to Know Too Much. I guess I was riffing on that great Hitchcock movie with Jimmy Stewart called The Man Who Knew Too Much. But Walter Mack has a remarkable record. He's a former federal prosecutor. He's an attorney specializing in corruption investigations. And one of the things that really impressed me about him is that not only does he know a lot about things like organized crime, corruption, police misconduct, and a whole lot else, it's that he's one of the most intrepid, just-the-facts-style diggers that I've ever seen. I'd say his approach is more Lieutenant Columbo than a tough-talking detective on Law and Order or something like that. He's always asked a great many questions from what I've seen, and then proceeds to pursue the evidence that he uncovers wherever the facts lead. And that's something I guess all the investigators like to say they do, but it doesn't always happen. At the point when I wrote about him, Mr. Mack had just uncovered a previously hidden crime wave in which corrupt contractors and dishonest union officials had cheated hardworking union carpenters out of tens of millions of dollars in benefits. Well, normally that kind of work would earn medals, applause, but not always. As one top official of the Carpenters Union put it, after they decided they really didn't want Walter Mack investigating things for them anymore, quote, "Walter Mack is very thorough. In some cases, he is too thorough," end of quote. That's pretty much what former police commissioner Bill Bratton once said of him as well, when Mr. Mack's investigations into police corruption were going a little further than the then police commissioner wanted. And it's pretty much what Rudy Giuliani said as well when he was the U.S. attorney in Manhattan and Mr. Mack was leading the office's organized crime unit and uncovering a really bloody trail that led to the indictment of the top mafia boss in America. But none of that has ever thrown Walter Mack off his stride, I don't think. I don't think he's ever pulls his punches. He's got a remarkable background. He's the son of a wealthy corporate executive who's was a titan and managed to put the idea of putting soda into cans, advertising jingles onto the radio. But if he had a silver spoon, he didn't seem very interested in using it. When he graduated from Harvard in 1965, instead of going into the corporate world, he enlisted in the Marine Corps, which promptly sent him to Vietnam to lead a rifle company in the treacherous former DMZ between South Vietnam and North Vietnam. We'll ask him about that. He's got a wonderfully wry sense of humor. When we posed for a photo for our story in the Village Voice, Mr. Mack put on a toy deputy sheriff's badge on his bright red tie. It made for a great photo. Welcome, Walter Mack. Thanks so much for joining us and hanging in there as I read that long screed about you.
It's nice to be here, Tom. Good to hear from you.
All right.
So, well, fire away.
All right.
For whatever you got for me today.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, incoming. Get ready. You know,
ready.
I wanted to do this show around Veterans Day, because I figured that you have some things to say on that subject. What made you join the Marines right out of Harvard College?
Well, I think at the time I was pretty much into, I would say, patriotic views, and I'm sort of and continue to be an adrenaline freak. I figure I enjoy myself the most when I'm facing fairly significant challenges and criticism, and basically that's sort of been a response throughout my life. I think that's probably what it is. I like to do different things and take on exciting challenges, and at that time, Vietnam was a challenge that many people ducked, and I felt it would be good for me were I to go ahead and take it on.
I remember
don't
you
regret that.
You told me that your mother, who you told me I think was opposed to, I guess, all wars, sent you off with a copy of a book by Bernard Fall, the great and prophetic writer about Vietnam, as well as a really big pistol, a Colt Python Magnum. It was quite a send-off gift. Did you read the book and use the gun?
I've read most of Bernard Fall's books, although some time ago, and the reality of being in combat in Vietnam was that if you carried anything that was strange, and specifically that weapon, which I still have, it was a Colt Python 357 Magnum. I don't think they had 44 Magnums, and I never carried it because if you were in the field, the likelihood of drawing fire from the NVA was vastly enhanced if you looked different, if you carried something other than what everybody else was carrying, if you wore your any sign of rank, if you had radio antennas around you, and carrying a big 357 Magnum, I think it was a 6-inch barrel, meant that, you know, you were special.
Okay.
You were sometimes the CIA people who assigned us would carry something different, and they would take most of the incoming fire. So you learned very quickly that you wanted to blend in, you wanted to look like any and everyone else and not sound like a boss or a medic or somebody who was carrying special gear. So the weapon was never used, never fired in Vietnam. It returned, but I've kept it since.
All right. I remember you describing that the Marines gave you a sheet, maybe it was a few sheets, of mimeographed paper that they called lessons learned. And that phrase, I think, rang a bell with you. You still use it?
I use it all the time because I'm slower than most people in figuring out what's going on around me. But basically, if you give me enough time, I figure it out. And figuring it out is a process whereby you get lessons learned, whether they come in mimeograph or they come in a phone call or an email or a text. You enhance your capability of accomplishing your goals by constantly being open to learning new things and to learning lessons from mistakes you make. And in Vietnam, it was an indelible lesson, because if the VC or the North Vietnamese were using a new technique or a new way of arming something or new ambush techniques, your life in many ways depended on getting that information and then adjusting your own behavior in order to be aware of it. So I think I pretty much carried that through.
You were captain of a rifle company. It was a job that had an awful lot of responsibility. Men's lives literally depended on you. You had some key tools that you used to try to protect everybody and make sure the job got done. You want to tell us about some of those?
Well, again, those were lessons learned. I mean, if we had a North Vietnamese contemporary who were trying to undo us or kill us, they would say that you could always tell Americans were in the field because you could smell their cologne, or if they were chewing gum, you could tell, or they were too damn noisy and what have you. And I tried to make as many examples of that type of situation, that if you expected to survive the joys of being in combat in that area, which is I Corps, the Northern Corps in Vietnam, you had to be unseen. You didn't want to be easily found. And you wanted your efforts to go as successfully as you could make them. And that was a constant series of learning lessons and acting and gaining the expertise to move in that countryside without getting yourself blown up or killed.
And then you were ordered, I think, to take some R&R, like take off. And I think you were promised that your squad would not be sent out in the field while you were away because you weren't sure that somebody else would be as careful as you were. But that didn't happen, did it?
No, it didn't. That's probably my biggest regret of my time in that country. We were up near a fire base called Camp Carroll at the time. I agreed to go for an R&R, which every company grade officer had to take it. At least one. I had not taken any, and I was near the end of my 12 months, 20 days there. And I was promised by the CO that all of my company would be moved back into the lines at Carroll. Unfortunately, our company was a very, very good company, a very well-experienced company. That's thanks to the NCOs, basically, who were outstanding with field craft, and the company. Two platoons of the company were sent out as a reaction force and walked into a traditional North Vietnamese ambush, and was the worst. As they say, we had suffered actually quite a very few casualties. There were 60 dead killed while I was in Hong Kong, and I came back to basically a decimated company and extreme disappointment, to say the least. So it was a burning, terrible experience, which I've thought a lot about. And, of course, my wife's view was, had I been there, I might have been part of the KIA. But my point was, my job would have been, it would not have happened the way it did happen had I been there. I have no doubt of that.
At some point, Walter Mack, you changed your mind about the war in Vietnam. What prompted that?
Well, again, I had a pretty cushy first maybe 6 months, 5 months. I was in an MP battalion in Da Nang, which was was bunking where probably the most attractive hotels are now in Vietnam for the many people who go there on China Beach. And so The situation was when I moved up to an infantry company, I think it was around December of, back then, 67, we took a route, I think it was Route 7, that ran east-west. And when we were going out west to go to the Camp Carroll LZ Stud in the direction of Quezon, there were beautiful rice paddies, outstanding, very open Vietnam, South Vietnam, really at its best. So I've spent about 6 months, maybe 7 months there, never coming back to Dong Ha, which was the area that started off. But on the way back, where had been really small villages and open rice paddies and somewhat of a bucolic, there were nothing but refugee camps. Kids running around asking for sea rations and what have you. And to anyone, it was, at least to me, it was very clear that our presence there and what the populace were going through was certainly not something that was seen to be good and certainly not enjoyed. It definitely looked like the society was breaking down. The battle of Wei had occurred. And I actually came back and joined Vietnam Veterans Against the War. I thought I was pretty confident that eventually we would be asked to leave. And of course, history makes that true. A very painful withdrawal, one that in many ways seems to have been duplicated recently on our withdrawal. I mean, we didn't seem to learn much from that, our withdrawal from Afghanistan, which to any veteran, and certainly my Marine Corps Mafia veterans are just shocked and outraged by not having learned the lessons we should have learned in fighting in Vietnam.
Yeah, lessons learned. Let me remind folks, this is WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. The show's called Deadline NYC. My name's Tom Robbins. I'm talking to Walter Mack. He's a veteran attorney. He's a former United States prosecutor. He's done a lot of stuff. Mr. Mack, you went to law school and you joined a white shoe law firm, and I guess you were on a track that would have had a pretty good pay scale and fairly interesting work, but you threw that over and decided to become a United States prosecutor. Why was that? Was that adrenaline rush thing again?
I think there's some of that, but also I attribute it to an old friend, a person who served with Bob Morgenthau in the Manhattan DA's office, who worked with me, I worked for him to be precise, as a junior associate. And his name was Norm Ostrow, well known by the criminal defense bar, a wonderful guy, who took me aside while we were working on a criminal case. And he said, I see you. I know what you're doing. The sooner you can leave this setting and get to a public prosecutor's office, the happier you will be. And I will write a recommendation for you to go to the U.S. attorney. And he did, and I did. Mm-hmm. And I spent a lot of time there doing some of the most enjoyable legal work that a young lawyer can do.
One of your cases, U.S. attorney. One of your cases in the Southern District of New York, the Marquee office of the Department of Justice, and maybe it was your biggest, was against a crew of Brooklyn car thieves that were led by a man named Roy DeMeo, who was, I don't know, was he a member or a captain of the Gambino crime family?
Yeah, I would call him a street captain reporting to a higher captain who wasn't on the street. So, but he was definitely a street captain in Brooklyn.
And along with, I mean, they weren't just stealing cars. They were killing a whole lot of people. It was a pretty grisly case, wasn't it? And it took a long time.
It took a long time. It started as an auto crime case. It evolved into a what they call a RICO case with murders. Roy was accused. Let me be more precise. The New York City Police Department and the FBI were working together, believe it or not, on the case.
Uh-huh.
And
miracle.
The police department was able to clear 150 homicides attributable to Mr. DeMeo and the people that worked for him.
Wait a minute. Time out. Did you say 150 homicides?
150 homicides.
Did you recover 150 bodies in that investigation?
No, well, they had a technique which was the part of went on in the courtroom of shooting and killing somebody at a particular location, putting him in a pool liner or something equivalent, or in a shower, wrapping him up, cutting whoever, male or female, whoever the victims were, into pieces, and utilizing a carting organization to dump the pieces in the various dumps around the city, where the rats would basically dispose of the remains. So no, very few were recovered.
The Gemini Lounge, I believe, is the name.
Gemini Lounge.
Their hangout, which happens to be close to the Fountain Avenue landfill. I drove by there recently. Have you seen it in a while? It's like it's a public park now.
I haven't seen it in a while. It's a very different situation than it was back there when I was looking at it here.
You know, the case led you to an indictment of the guy who at the time was the boss of the Gambino crime family, Paul Castellano. Did it surprise you? I mean, you knew that it was an organized crime case, but these were serial killers. You just said 150 homicides. I mean, did it surprise you that the Godfather was directly connected to them?
If you had spent as much time as I did in the organized crime area, basically your ability to move up in whatever circles in the organized crime family you were in was in large part a reflection of your ability to be a good earner, and that meant money coming up and ending up at the highest levels of the family. There, although Paul, as you know, didn't make it to verdict,
mm-hmm.
and at the same time, it was pretty clear that what started off as a pretty much a street crime car theft case ended up, as we were fortunate and kept digging, going all the way up to the boss, that the monies that were earned by whatever operations they had, murder, loan shark, porno, pornography, loan sharking, as well as auto crime, and some drugs, basically all the whatever money was earned by those activities, some portion of it gravitated or actually raised to the top. And that's where Paul was eventually indicted. And as I say, he was shot and killed in front of Sparks.
Right.
So we never made it to verdict. And Jimmy LaRosa, a wonderful lawyer, criminal defense attorney, were he still alive, I think he passed fairly recently, would say the jury would not have convicted him. Of course, I have a differing view. And virtually all the people that were there sitting beside Paul during that case were convicted, and I think Paul would have been as well. But it was a battle.
Well, bless you, Walter Mack, giving Jimmy LaRosa his due, even though he's not around to receive it for saying
not
that
around, but
he would have wanted it for you. Listen, let me just tell people that if this story sounded intriguing to you, there is a pretty great book, remarkably dramatic tale, called Murder Machine. It's written by my old Daily News buddies, Gene Mustaine and Jerry Capisi, and there's a pretty nice profile of Walter Mack in there. And the book is still in print. It's out there. I don't mind making a plug for it. I think you'd enjoy the read. Well, while you were a prosecutor at the Southern District, Walter Mack, Rudy Giuliani became the top U.S. attorney, and his claim to fame was that he broke the back of the mafia. And I have never understood why he had a problem with a top prosecutor. You were the head of the organized crime division, right?
That was true.
And you had just indicted the boss of the Gambino crime family. I know you've had time to think about this one as well. What went wrong with you and Rudy Giuliani back then?
Well, certainly there are some interesting developments since then.
Well, I was going to ask you about that too, but
yeah, okay.
But then he seemed fairly sane, right?
No, he was. You know, he was a good U.S. attorney. I think his predecessor, a good friend of mine, John Martin, who was the U.S. attorney, basically had given me the resources and the personnel to make terrific organized crime cases during this time period. And for reasons that really only Rudy can describe, when Rudy came in, it was clear that he wanted to gain whatever for the cases that were coming down. He wanted to get the credit for them. He had a good idea about a commission case. We could talk about that for an hour. But basically, at that time, I'm not a basically credit-seeking person. I find that I get a lot more done I just keep my mouth quiet. I believe it's hard to believe given what I'm saying today. But basically, you know, just do the job and try to do it. And you get plenty of opportunity to say what you need to say in front of a jury in the courtroom. There's really no need to be out making, doing press and things of that nature. You got plenty of scope. But most judges appreciate it being said in the courtroom, not in front of a press conference. And Rudy, for reasons, I think he was very intent on moving politically. Obviously, I think the facts show that. And he felt to some extent that I was not acceding as much as he would like to what he wanted done, and that I was maybe perhaps overly resourced. And I think he was looking for that credit of being the organized crime buster in residence in New York City at the time. I don't know. I'm still friendly with Rudy. He's fired me about two or three times, one way or the other, over the years. And I actually am very sympathetic to his situation now.
Oh, well, wait a minute. Now, just a minute. Hold on a second. Now, what do you mean you're sympathetic to his situation now? Well, this is a man who, you know, as we've been learning more and more from the hearings, was inebriated on the night of the election, charged his way into the Oval Office, and insisted that the President of the United States go out and declare victory, even though he knew he didn't. What do you mean you're sympathetic to him? I don't understand.
Well, I mean, here's where I'm sympathetic, and this is a theory that some of my friends, some of whom have passed on recently, unfortunately, since I'm an ancient type, but basically you reach a point, I think, as you move on and you're used to it. Certainly Rudy is, in being the, you know, in the fanfare and being a matter of comment and all the accolades that he's received, and all of a sudden that stops. Or is not as intense as it used to be. I think people make mistakes on saying and doing things that, you know, try to regain the fame, light, or the interest of the world, press, public, whatever, in doing things. And I think Rudy, in some way, is a victim of that as well. And it's not an unusual thing for those who get up there in their 70s and what have you. You want to still be there. And I'm sympathetic to that view because I think it's a natural thing. As you move on, you sort of feel, gee whiz, there was a time everybody wanted to know what I was doing. And sometimes that curbs your judgment. And that's sort of the way I look at it. Certainly, no Rudy
at his best. What about what happened to law and justice and order, Walter Mack? I mean, come on.
You know, my feeling is this. I wish him good legal advice. I know his lawyers, at least some of them.
He's probably going to need it.
I hate to see him in a situation because I've known him at his best.
You're a good and generous man, Walter Mack. So we have to do some business here for a minute. So
sure.
If you could just hang in with us for the next Okay, next few minutes. Then we're going to have a little music after this. This is crunch time, fundraising time at WBAI. This show, Deadline NYC, has probably been particularly remiss in not hitting up listeners out there in radio land for donations to WBAI. And I know you thought that just because you can flick on the dial that WBAI is free. And it is. It's free to listeners who just turn on the radio. But it's got expenses, big ones. And there is a tower right smack in Midtown someplace that I understand charges very, very high rents. And that's the tower that is broadcasting, I believe, the signal that people can hear right now. And the rent is due. And I believe the rent is due in this office where I'm sitting right now on Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn. So I'm asking folks who are out there who may have listened to this show, who may enjoy it, who want to give some support, to give a call to this donation line, 212-209-2950, or I think there's a...
Yeah, that's it.
All right. Reggie says I don't have it. I've never understood the
No, you're right so far, so, you know, continue on.
I'll stick with that. You know, I got to say the one thing about BII in general is I think the important thing is to remember is that it's many voices. You know, I used to work at the Village Voice, and I used to take a lot of flack for stuff that other people wrote, and I didn't necessarily disagree with them, but I would say to them, you know, the Village Voice is many voices. And the same goes for WBAI. And you may hear some wacky stuff, but you will also hear, I think, some truly great, truly informative, truly important stuff. And it is free speech radio, and it's our voice. It's the only place on the radio dial. So if you're a fan of this show or even just someone who likes to cruise by the radio dial, please think about making a contribution, $5, $10, $20, whatever you can. The number is 212-209-2950. Reggie, you want to pitch in?
I think you said it all. Just to add on to that, if you enjoy some of the long playing, and this is not a detriment whatsoever, the long playing interviews that Tom has been doing for the past couple of years with Deadline NYC, I definitely think you should support his efforts on creating these interviews, because here at WBAI, this is definitely distinct in what Tom is doing here every Monday at 5 p.m. What he is bringing, it's kind of an intriguing type of radio that you don't hear anymore. It's part conversation, there's part current events, and it's also part historical aspects to it, and it's all connected. And I think that you will learn something, and just like if you learn anything, all the good and sometimes not so good here at WBAI, you can pledge to this radio station and show your support to our endeavors here, specifically Tom Robbins, by calling 212-209-2950 or go to give to WBAI.org. And Tom is not wrong when he said that we owe money to the transmitter. We do. 2 months behind the rent, which is $17,000 a month, as well as 3 months behind the rent here at 388 Atlantic Avenue, $10,000 a month. You could do the math on that. And we're doing this campaign to fulfill both of those things that we need to do by the end of this month. So technically, it's possible. It can be done. But I think that the listeners need to know what we need from the listeners. And since we are solely supported by listeners, and we don't get any endowments from corporations or government or anything like that, we don't even get CPB money, Corporation of Public Broadcasting. Now, story may have that we may get that, but that won't be a thing until next year. So we need to pay the rent now.
Need to pay the rent. All right.
212-209-2950 and back over to you, Tom.
Okay, thank you for those kind words summing up this show. We're going to take a quick music break, and then we'll be back with Walter Mack, intrepid investigator, former U.S. attorney. Reggie, you want to hit the play button on that tasty little tune that we got lined up? Rita Payne, 1971, Bring the Boys Home, Turn Those Ships Around. A few years after, our guest Walter Mack served there with the Marines. Walter Mack, you went at one point, I guess soon after you left the Southern District of New York, to the New York City Police Department, which had just had one of its biggest police corruption scandals in the early 90s there. Some cops were found to be more interested in stealing drugs from dealers than arresting them. And you were brought in to oversee the department's Internal Affairs Bureau, the first civilian, I think. I'm curious. Was it tougher chasing corruption in the NYPD than chasing the mob?
To some extent, it was. I mean, I was always a law enforcement person. I was certainly advised by many that by my taking that job on, I would be incurring wrath and disappointment by colleagues. And there were others who said the other side, and that is they needed somebody who had investigated cases pretty intensely to be in that position. I think what was at stake was whether or not the department could muster the fortitude and skill to police its own.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did. I got hired by Ray Kelly, former Marine, a Vietnam Marine, an artillery Marine, and basically trying to get people to recognize the internal affairs function as being a valuable one and one of importance. But we brought important cases. That was the time of the Dirty 30 and various other things. And I think one of the, if there was any kind of general approach I had, was to utilize the same techniques that had been used in the organized crime or narcotics area to look at cops and what have you, and using undercovers and interesting various operations. And there was
interesting is a good word. You actually at one point had a brothel going, right, as a sting operation.
Exactly right, with the permission of Mr. Morgenthau at the Manhattan DA's office, and the madam at the brothel was outraged at the license that was taken by the vice cops on her situation. So she allowed us for, I think, a week or 2 weeks to put video and audio. And I don't think we did any criminal. I think we may have done one or two criminal cases, but most were administrative cases where it was clear that the individuals at the squad at the time were not acting, let's say, consistently with patrol guide, let's put it that way, and received some discipline. Uh-huh. And, you know, it was just being fairly aggressive, but certainly techniques that were certainly being used by other law enforcement types throughout the country.
We should just clarify for folks who the Ray Kelly, this is during the Dinkins administration we're talking
the
about.
The Dinkins administration.
So your appointment as the first civilian head of the IAB, the Internal Affairs Bureau, was, I don't know if City Hall had a say in it, but it was certainly done not with their disapproval, and it was a different era at the time. What was the feedback that you got after some of these operations eventually?
Well, it was clear that I was not acting in the minds of many, certainly the bosses, consistently with what was expected of the internal affairs function. I was utilizing techniques of undercovers and turning people back in, which were, you know, normal techniques in various other areas, narcotics and organized crime. And you know, there were some valid arguments. Cops who basically had committed crimes, permitting them to stay within the department for a period of time to gain evidence. And, you know, there were some, you know, some legitimate excuses, but Mr. Bratton, Commissioner Bratton and Commissioner Kelly had differing views of the utility of that function. And so it wasn't too long after Bill Bratton took over that I was shown the door, is what it boiled down to. That, as I say, and that was approved by Rudy, so I count that as one of Rudy's firings.
The second time you're fired by Rudy Giuliani, who you still defend to this day. You know, I went back.
You know, I'm a defense lawyer too. You know, so I can argue almost any side.
You're doing a good job, Walter Mack. You know, I went back and I looked at some of the clips because that always fascinated me, that moment when you had a change of administrations. You know, the first black mayor who was really trying to do something, his view on the police. The cops did not love him. We know they staged a mini riot. Forget the mini part. They staged a riot outside of City Hall in which a lot of ugly words were said. So the relations between City Hall and the police were pretty bad. But one of the things that I noticed in the clips, the newspaper clips, was that, you know, the Abner Louima case, that really hideous right. attack that had taken place where this poor man had literally been gored with a by the stick, by the cops.
Blue stick handle.
Yeah. And that I had forgotten, or Blue maybe stick, I never yeah. knew, that he had tried to call the NYPD to report. And it was never entered into the official incident log. And his family had to call back, I guess, 36 hours, a day and a half later. And that was when the investigation started. And that gave all the culprits enough time to get their story straight.
No, I know.
And that was one of the things I think you were going to try to figure out. Did you make any headway on that one?
Well, you know, I could tell you, it's another hour or 2 hours of discussion about what sort of obstacles were overcome. But I will tell you what the line was, and I think one of the successes that we had, besides the criminal cases that came that were deserved, and as you know, the Mullen Commission was in action at that time. They were conducting hearings, and basically what the department feared was that the efficacy of the internal affairs function was so poor that there needed to be an outside individual or group to do it. And I think we demonstrated, which was, I think, a credit, that there was no one better to investigate cops than cops. They, FBI and various other federal agencies don't have the expertise. They don't know the streets well enough. They are not going to be as effective as a motivated professional internal affairs function. And I think that was something that Judge Mullen, may his soul rest in peace, a fine gentleman, came to realize and was part of their report, that there's no one better than a properly run internal affairs organization. Hmm. But getting cops within the department to recognize how important integrity and juror belief in the integrity of the police officers testifying at trial is essential to their being considered effective and successful. And basically, you know, cops are supposed to be professionals, and they're going through that phase again. They're basically, the questions around the country are they professional? Have they learned lessons? Are they going to act consistently with best practices? Mm-hmm. And it's something that reoccurs frequently.
One of the issues you had with Bill Bratton after he took over as police commissioner had to do with a guy who was known as Officer Otto. He was a secret witness who I gather had been pretty productive, but you said he wanted to know who he was, and you said, "I cannot tell you." That was sort of an odd thing to tell your boss, no?
No, well, he certainly thought so, but the reality of the situation was that a very good friend, a lawyer who represented him, asked Ray Kelly and I to come to a meeting in which we met with that individual, and both of us gave our word that we would never reveal his identity unless the lawyer and his client, Officer Otto, agreed. And I certainly had been involved in my prior practice with the U.S. attorney that, you know, you're either a person of your word or you're not. And it was at that situation. I tried to explain that situation to Commissioner Bratton and others. But obviously it was more of, hey, I'm the boss and you don't, you know, that was not something that endeared me to him, that I would have some kind of higher obligation to keep my word, which is something that's always been important to me. Mm.
The honorable man who wanted to know too much. To your credit. I'm curious. I'm sure that you're following some of the efforts that have been underway to try to at least curb police misconduct. One of the things that's happening is that there's more information. Some of it's actually online these days. Do you have any sense of whether or not some of the new steps have had any impact?
Well, it's maybe too early to tell. I have to admit, as I've been watching things over the last 2 years, you know, I've felt strongly. I'm a pro-police person, been a police person in the Marine Corps as well as in civilian. And my feeling is that the biggest issue is making sure that leadership understands professional training and what's expected and what's going on. And, you know, my experience has been that a properly disciplined-led police department is a resource for any community, especially the communities that have the highest crime rates. But it's troubling when those lessons seem to be lost. And in many ways, I wrote a couple of letters and things of that nature saying, hey, this is a matter of training. This is a matter of discipline. Mm. This is a matter of leadership, which, of course, is the Marine Corps way of approaching almost any problem. Hmm. But I think it's coming around. I think people are going to recognize that there are faults on both sides, but law and order and safety and integrity are ingredients that need to be delivered by whatever law enforcement organization is in place.
Hmm. Hmm. All right. Well, good luck with that so far. We'll see how it turns out.
We'll see how it turns out.
Let me just see. You know, I met you when you were doing all the Carpenters Union work as the independent monitor. And in fact, you had come in, I think, right after the second guy in a row at the head of the union had been carted away for being arrested and convicted of taking thousands of dollars in bribes. And the leadership was telling you that we got it. It's all cleaned up. And then you found out that that wasn't exactly true. And it's a long, tangled tale. But I'm just curious, were you shocked at what you found after you started digging around to realize the extent of corruption on New York's corruption construction sites?
You know, I'm never shocked by that, Tom. I hate to say this. You know what I mean? I'm not that cynical that I expect it. But basically, I'm not a person who sees a few things and say, well, that's it, it's over with. But I think what's important, always been important to me, is being willing to dig down deep. And frequently when you dig down deep and dig up what you need to be, plus whatever you've learned, whatever lessons you've learned and experienced, often you come out right. You've gained enough experience to be able to accurately predict what you should be looking for. And if you find it, then, especially if you've had an experience like me and having practiced before New York City jurors and their cynicism and what they expect, that you can make a pretty good judgment as to whether or not the facts you have and the information you have is going to be adequate to convince them beyond a reasonable doubt, unanimously, which is the standard, at least in the courts that I practice, that your point of view is the one that should prevail. And you got to know the facts, and the facts change.
Let me ask you this. Did you get a sense of why it is that carpenters and other construction workers, I guess, were so vulnerable to corruption on the job? What was it that left them so open to it?
Well, you know, I don't think it's so simplistic as to say money, but money and large amounts of it, and the importance of having the honor and of holding your job, of taking care of your family. And if you, as in many professions, and certainly in the union world, if you are considered someone who is out for themselves and you are the one that's going to turn them in, I mean, police department certainly suffers from this, that, you know, you are ostracized. You'll never work again. If an employer thinks that the shop steward is going to tell what the employer is doing, that's the last time that shop steward's going to work. And that kind of enforcement, unless there is a vigorous investigative, effort, coupled with firm leadership that is unwilling to tolerate any form of corruption, those are the kinds of things where integrity can go south. And that's true in almost any profession. Doesn't have to be labor. It happens in large corporations all the time.
Yes, but
money corrupts.
But often those things go on and corrupt, and nobody catches them. Let me just tell folks out there that it was too complicated to go into. But if not for Walter Max, very diligent digging, and he would bring in a lot of well-meaning carpenters who were, I think, pretty scared and sit them down and depose them at length. And as a result of doing that to several dozen people, he turned up a massive, a massive corruption scandal that was, as I said before, costing the union and the members millions of dollars, but also was pointing out, like, there were so many corrupt officials that were on the site. Let me ask you this, Walter Mack. Do you think the mob is still a factor in this kind of work or in the city at large?
I can say that, and I should say, Tom, that now, you know, I'm a Criminal Justice Act defense lawyer, so I frequently get appointed by a court to defend people. And as I say, half jokingly, I can argue almost either side. But my view is this: one, I'm not, I have many, I won't kind of call them informants, but friends that are still in the Carpenters Union, some in the Laborers Union, because I oversaw them for a while. And they call me and tell me what's going on, and I trust them because I know them. Or even if I don't know them, I trust them because I know their voice. And they would say that many of the same things that have gone on are still going on. Do I have any personal knowledge of that? I'm not actively involved in that anymore, so I can't really profess it. But I know people who trust me and call me or talk to me. They're telling me things have not changed an awful lot.
Really? So, I'm impressed that you're still taking the time to talk to people all these years later, because we were talking about quite a while ago.
That's getting closer.
I'm sorry, say that again?
No, I'm just joking with you. I mean, I'm still living and breathing here. I enjoy talking to people.
Well, I do too, but it's also...
I know so, you do.
People, when they call you from, like, stories I've written years and years back, I have to scratch my head and remember, what did I write when about who?
I know, well, me too.
So that's a little distressing. So, I mean, after all these years of there being a consent decree that was governing the work of the District Council of Carpenters, that there still is that kind of, at least, corruption hazard that's going on. I'm disappointed to hear that. But I'm also heartened the fact that you still get calls from rank-and-file members looking for an honest voice to be able to, you know, speak to and talk to.
Well, whether what they're saying is accurate or not, you know, there are a lot of truth-telling tests to go through, so I'm certainly not informed enough to have a personal opinion. I hope that they're wrong. I hope that things have improved, and there are some very good people in the Carpenters Union who always have been good and are intent on delivering integrity.
So yeah, no question. I would say no question. Some of the best people I ever met, I met in the course of reporting on that District Council of Carpenters. So let me drag you into something else that I don't know if you'll be comfortable doing it. But you, when I sat with you back to do that story in 2006, you talked a lot, and you really said, I think, the same thing here this evening, about people have to be held accountable for what they do, that was one of the things that drew you to becoming a prosecutor. And I know this one's a bit out of your current strike zone, but based on what you've seen, and I'm sure you're paying attention to these hearings, do you think the Department of Justice should bring charges against former President Trump? You can dodge it. If you think that he's going to hire you, you can dodge this. That's all right.
He's certainly not going to hire me.
He's certainly not going to hire
me. No question of that.
Okay.
But, you know, my feeling is there are a lot, you know, a prosecutor, and I'll put my old prosecutor's hat on, there are a lot of factors. I mean, I pretty much said that today. And you really have to go through it. I think it's a lot closer than people think. I mean, there's one side, well, I mean, how can he take the view? And there's one side of me that says, hey, you know, let me grab the facts as I see them. But it's, you know, it's like the war in Ukraine. You can say, well, gee whiz, how can this happen? But basically, there's always a response, and I certainly can anticipate what the responses of the president and the people, or former president and around him, would be. And I think it's a tough judgment. It's one that you've really got to see the transcripts. You've got to look at the witnesses, and I've been certainly looking at them and listening to it.
What's your feeling after just? I mean, are you impressed with the hearings as to the job they're doing?
I think they're doing a good job. But, I mean, having been in the courtroom as long as I have, you know, there's always more to do. There's, you know, you're in the middle of things. There are all little nuances. That's why I'm a fact guy and try to take a look at people and say, okay, if that person is testifying in D.C., in Virginia, in, you know, in New York, What's a juror, a likely juror that I know and certainly know has spent a lot of time with? What are they going to think about this witness? Hmm. Is that a case? I mean, a criminal case, Tom, they're not easy. Beyond a reasonable doubt, unanimously.
Well, I hear you there, and I know that you're a cautious and careful guy. I read an op-ed today, you know, saying that the Attorney General needs to proceed carefully. I think, though, I'm going to drop him a note and say that I think he needs a special prosecutor named Walter Mack to pick up this case and handle the prosecution, yay or nay, whether he says bring the charges or not. Is there going to be a book? I know you're married to a journalist. Is there going to be a Walter Mack book that I could look forward to reading?
When I got fired from the – I thought about it. I actually was reading the Times book review, and I noticed that my friend John Gleason has now written
a story about it.
And so, it's one of these things that I can understand, but – my feeling is that I've told my son that when I start writing a book about what I've done, it's time to put me down. So I don't think I am.
No one's putting you down.
Gone.
No one's putting you down. Well, that's as far as we can go. I mean, if we don't get the book, at least we got a good story. Thank you, Walter Mack, so much for taking the time this evening and talking to us. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Don't forget to, give a shout-out, 212-209-2950. Thanks, Reggie Johnson, and we'll let Eddie Lockjaw Davis take the last few moments here with Stolen Moments. Take care, everyone.
Previous program was Deadline NYC, heard Mondays at 5 p.m. here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned for the WBAI Evening News with Paul DiRienzo. That's coming up in mere seconds. But again, this is taking a little bit of time to remind people. And I still can't believe that management is just allowing me to do this, considering what the past was when I've said this before. But anyway, if I'm given the opportunity of doing this, well, I'm going to say it until not. WBAI, as you know, is in the middle of its campaign to raise money for the transmitter tower, which is true. The transmitter cost is $17,000 a month. That is true. Also, we're 2 months behind the rent at the transmitter, as well as being 3 months behind the rent here at 388 Atlantic Avenue. And just like everything in life in a capitalist system,